All right. Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein, and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you, my fellow millennials, should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Lisa Huff. She's VP of Strategic Relations at Custodia Bank. Her extensive knowledge of Bitcoin mining and leadership qualities have earned her a respect of fellow professionals in the field, and she was recently acknowledged as a leader in Bitcoin by Forbes. With a background as a commodities trader, Lisa brings a unique perspective and expertise that drives the convergence of energy and Bitcoin. And finally, she's the first female guest on this show, so I'm super excited to talk with her. Yeah, welcome, Lisa.
I did not know I'm the first female guest on the show. How could you
I be? Reached out to a lot of them, but I don't know. So you'll just set the precedent, and then hopefully many more will follow. But thanks for coming on. I've been following you with great attention. I love your backstory that I heard, I think, on Robert Breedlove's podcast about your corporate journey also through Enron, which is, I think, is interesting. And the convergence of energy and Bitcoin is, I think, something that we'll definitely talk about. But first, I wanted to ask you, which generation do you belong to, and how do you experience explaining Bitcoin to your generational peers? Like, what's their main challenge to understand it?
Oh gosh, I don't even know what generation I belong to.
I don't want to guess.
I don't associate with an age group. I don't know what generation I belong to, frankly. And I have friends that are 20, so many friends that are in their 30s because of Bitcoin. And then I've got a really good friend that I've known for 25 years that just turned 90. And I talked to all those people about Bitcoin.
Cool. Well, what maybe the different question is, what do you see across all these different age brackets, like in the understanding of Bitcoin, or like their beliefs or perceptions about money and finance?
Well, I can tell you, I was recently up in Dallas. I attended a family gathering, not my family, but the family gathering. I think it was for Rosh Hashanah. I can't remember. And the matriarch of this family is a woman who's almost 90, and her name's Elaine. And she hosted this beautiful party. Her whole family was there. I mean, just, you know, everything about the event was lovely and special. And she gave her guests a lot of attention, you know, tell me what you do. Tell me about your life. Tell me, you know, and by the way, people that ask good questions are the best people to sit with, right? Like such a joy when you sit with people who are just generally absorbing information and receptive. And I said, well, Elaine, she said, what do you do? Do you work? And I said, yeah, I work in Bitcoin. And she said, oh, I don't know anything about it, but I know it's going to be the global reserve currency.
Amazing. That's great.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
And so almost 90-year-old woman in Dallas, Texas.
And do you know how she got to that understanding?
Yeah, she reads like 4 newspapers a day, and apparently she doesn't believe anything she reads.
Oh, that's amazing. My grandmother had Bitcoin exactly the same.
You know,
oh my
put God. Two and yeah. two together and...
Wow. Yeah. Hey there. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I just really want to ask you for a quick favor. Over the last few months, I've seen that only 75% of people who listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube are actually subscribed. And the most important thing I'm currently focusing on, next to hopefully giving you interesting conversations, is growing this podcast subscriber base so I can continue with it into the future. I want to thank everyone who has been viewing and listening to Bitcoin for Millennials, leaving comments here and sending me DMs. It's been super, super motivating. So thank you so much. So I really want to ask you to please hit the subscribe button on YouTube or follow me on your favorite podcasting app if you are enjoying this podcast. Thanks again for joining me on this journey. Now back to the conversation. My grandmother had exactly the same when I would visit her. She always had 4 newspapers.
Fabulous.
And she knew everything that was going on in the world she got from the papers. But just as your friend, my grandmother was also very wary of what she was reading. But wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I love that. Perhaps even like people in that age bracket actually have a way better view of what happened to the money in general, right? Like from their adolescence up until now, like they really bought a bread for 30 cents and are now also paying $5, right? So perhaps they have the best view on what actually happened. Cool.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, in her case, in her family's case, I mean, you know, there's very vibrant, maybe vibrant's not the right word. They're very vivid, real memories of the Holocaust and real memories of, you know, crossing borders and leaving their country. So, you know, maybe that's why it's easier for some people than others to understand, not to kind of like dive into a super, you know, depressing topic, but people don't typically see Bitcoin until they feel pain because of something, right? Like, or yeah. More broadly, we don't feel the need to make a change in our life until the pain is such that we can't take it anymore. And I've used this example before, but my daughter, Ella, when she was a baby, she was literally the worst baby on earth. She never slept. She had her days and nights mixed up, and she cried like nonstop for weeks and weeks and weeks, probably until she was like 4 months old, which is just miserable. First child, had no idea what to expect as a parent. I had been trading at Enron, trading in the energy space, right, for my entire career. And then I decide to have a baby, have Ella. She comes out, she cries constantly, and I'm going, what am I doing? Like, what have I done with this, with my life? Anyway, long story short, she wouldn't sleep. And we hired a sleep specialist, paid this guy like $400 for an hour time period, which at the time, so it still does seem like a lot, but yeah. His name is Dr. Mark Weisbluth, and he's based in Chicago, and he had written this book that had gotten a lot of attention. And the first question, I mean, he sort of listened to us like describe what the situation was, but really his first question was, how much does she weigh? And we said, oh, she's like 15 or 17 pounds, whatever it was. She's 15 pounds. And he said, yeah, that sounds about right. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, 15 pounds is when parents just realize they cannot carry or hold their child all day and all night. And they're it's like, it's just too much weight to bear. They have to figure out how to get this child to sleep. And so when I think about why some people don't understand Bitcoin, it's for the same reason. They're not experiencing pain or destruction in a way that potentially someone who has, you know, whose family was, bore witness to the Holocaust or, you know, was a Holocaust survivor, it lived in that environment, right? Those memories are vivid and real. And having to abandon your country and having to leave your possessions or, you know, your wealth, right? Like having to leave what you've accumulated with nothing. Gives you a different sense maybe of Bitcoin than a person in the US whose belief is that their money works just fine.
Yeah. And well, up until a point, of course, their money does work just fine, right? As I just mentioned, like off mic, like why I'm focusing on millennials is especially because, yeah, in the West specifically, millennials grew up in the best time ever to grow up, you know, like you didn't even have to be what people would qualify rich to have a good life. You know, everyone has personal problems, obviously, but in general, you know, there weren't any real big problems. So you don't really question also the system that you basically are participating in. Like a few episodes back, I talked to Tony Yazbek, and he's from Lebanon, and he told the story about just losing everything, all his wealth overnight. And that he said it was basically like a shock. Like you cannot imagine that that is actually happening. And then you realize that it is happening and you still like you don't know what to do, right? So it's even when you're in that situation, it feels unreal. And when you're not in that situation, how can you even visualize that to understand that there's an actual problem, right? So I think in general, most people need to run into a very big problem, like a nuclear problem. And then, yeah, you start to move. But like when we connect it back to Bitcoin, I think I understand I now understand Bitcoin, and I came from a place of curiosity, I think, honestly, like not from a place of having a actual problem, which I would say is perhaps harder than having the actual problem and then looking for the solution, right? And I cannot really retrace my steps, like how I got here. I don't know. I think it's just curiosity. But I was wondering, like, who or what has been like your most influential, to you in shaping your views about like what is money and risk and wealth? Like how did you grow up and learn about that?
Not Bitcoin related or Bitcoin related?
Well, eventually it leads to Bitcoin, I think, but just in general, like those topics, like what is money or risk?
I feel really lucky. I have great parents, and they were not parents that coddled us. I had a job from the time I was 14 years old. I remember we had this big shopping center that opened in the area where I lived. And, you know, my mom one day just like dropped me off and was like, you need to go get a job here. And I was 14 years old, right? Like really too young to work. But I look back on that and I think, God, I have worked since I was 14 years old. Like this is, gave me such a huge appreciation for earning dollars or having your own money. We always had chores growing up as kids. I was telling Ella this the other day that I had this memory that came back to me. One of my chores was to do all the ironing in the family. And so at the end of the week, my dad, you know, would give us our allowance. And I would iron the dollar bills from my allowance and I'd put them in a box, right? And I'd neatly store them. Like I was obsessed with them being perfect. I wish that I would have known though at the time that even if we iron them and neatly keep them in a box and protect them, that they're still eroding before our eyes. I wish that that was part of the conversation, but anyway, maybe and factually it probably wasn't part of the conversation because that was really right at the time. It was in the same decade that that we left the gold standard. So, you know, anyway, I've worked since I was 14 years old. I love working. I love having, you know, purpose. And I think the greatest gift in Bitcoin is that when I speak to other Bitcoiners, regardless of what their job is, or regardless of how someone touches Bitcoin, even if it's especially if they don't even work in Bitcoin, they have such appreciation for the purpose that their life has because of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And so what was your aha moment when you realized Bitcoin was something to pay attention to?
That's right. You asked me who was my most influential person. Yeah. You know, I've told this story before, but I had an investment portfolio with a money manager who's, you know, much older white guy, and I wanted to make some changes. And he and I had some very philosophical conversations about the direction I thought my portfolio should go in versus, you know, his tried and true, this is what works. I've been doing this for 50 years. Look, I've helped all these people that you know, this pipe fitter has now retired, a multimillionaire, right? Like, let me just do this for you. And there was just something about that seemed, I don't know, like it just seemed like a scam to me. And so I started to dig into what was inside this portfolio that he had constructed. And I had discovered that I was in like 26 different mutual funds. And so many of them had the same investment, right? Most of them all had some allocation to Apple and Microsoft. And my interest was really in two things: technology, looking at, you know, what technology was coming at us, and also in energy. So I'd worked in the energy business for a long time. My dad worked in the energy business. You know, kind of my circle. I live in Houston. My circle of friends are all in the energy business. So, you know, I mean, maybe not super glamorous, but I felt like my portfolio should incorporate energy and technology. And this portfolio manager was like, well, they can be a small allocation, but they can't be the bulk of your portfolio. And I was like, you know what? Like, I just am going to make some different choices. And he got so mad at me. He said, well, if you're going to make different choices and if you're going to make adjustments, then you can just take all of your money out of our system. And so he asked me to remove, like, he basically said, close your accounts, like within this financial institution, close your accounts. And I was like, okay. So I opened up a TD Ameritrade account and started studying what I was interested in. And one of the things that came up repeatedly is this word blockchain. And so I asked Google, you know, how do I buy blockchain? And that's kind of how I started down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. But that was like maybe 2019, maybe like 2018, 2019. I met, I would say the person that's most influenced me on my Bitcoin journey, specifically about money, is Parker Lewis. So I had the wonderful opportunity to work with Parker Lewis at Unchained. And when you're around a Parker Lewis type person every day, it's like a fast course in the reality of our broken money and how Bitcoin fixes things.
And so I by the way, I would recommend anyone to read or watch the Bitcoin is Not a Hedge presentation by Parker, which is fantastic, I'd say.
It is.
What made you not get into Bitcoin when you first encountered it? I mean, nobody really gets it on the first try, right? Like, were there any things that you ran into?
Well, one of the things that I ran into, and this was probably before I closed my accounts with that money manager, is I started reaching out to friends that were in or acquaintances that were money managers, wealth managers. And I remember reaching out to one wealth manager whose name is Aaron, and he's youngish, a little bit younger than I am. He's sort of, you know, his claim to fame that he talks to everyone about is how early he was to Facebook, how much money he'd made for his parents putting them in Facebook. So I felt like, okay, he understands it. Like, he gets it, right? Like, he's more current than my previous money manager. And I called him one day and I said, hey, Aaron, what do you think of this Bitcoin? I think I'm going to buy some Bitcoin. What do you think of it? And he started laughing at me. And he said, Lisa, I make it a point not to lose money for my clients. And in that moment, it sort of just clicked for me that I wasn't going to ask anybody else what their opinion was on Bitcoin. I would go seek information about Bitcoin, but I was not going to go to someone in the traditional world and ask them their opinion, because they had no incentive to find out and they weren't curious, right? Nothing was broken. The baby wasn't too heavy. They weren't having to set the baby down. You know, he was managing 10 people's wealth and collecting a fee and doing fine. And in that moment, I really realized, like, I'm not going to ask anyone else. And I also, it sort of takes me back to my first job in the energy space. So I had applied for a job. When I graduated from college, you still read the newspaper and you looked at the job postings in the physical newspaper.
Yeah.
And I replied to an ad in the physical newspaper, the Houston Chronicle. And it turned out that the company that I was applying to was Fibro Energy. And Fibro was the commodities trading desk for Solomon Brothers. So apparently 400 people applied for two jobs. They were analyst jobs. And I got one of them and a guy named Toby got the other one. I went to work for Fibro. I don't know how many weeks I was there, not very many. We all worked on this gigantic trading floor. Everyone had the same, like, you know, Herman Miller type chair, the same, you know, computer. If you were a trader and the more senior you were, you might have had six screens, right? I had one. And the traders had much bigger phones with all these buttons and headsets and all that. And I just had a phone. But I looked around and I thought, you know, these guys that are making so much more money that have five more computer screens than me and a bigger phone, like, they're not any smarter. Nobody wakes, nobody is born into this world as a commodities trader. Like, I can do this. And I also realized that you didn't need an MBA, right? There were some of those guys that probably didn't have college degrees. I mean, I don't know, but like, traders are an interesting lot. And I just thought, they're not any smarter than I am. I should just be trading, right? Like, at the time I was making, I'll never forget this because I thought it was all the money in the world. But my first job at Fibro, I was making $28,000 a year. And when they offered me the job, the woman I went to work for, her name was Catherine, made the offer. And I was like, oh, thank you. Yes, I accept. And she hadn't told me the salary yet. And she said, well, don't you even want to know what the salary is? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. What's the salary? It's $28,000. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, wow, that's a ton. But then, of course, you start, you get there, and I'm fresh out of college. I now have some sense of what salaries are and what the jobs are. And I look around, I'm like, these guys are making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're not any smarter than I am. So in that moment where I called Aaron, the wealth manager, to ask about Bitcoin, and he said, Lisa, I make it a practice not to lose my clients' money. I sort of had that recollection of that moment when I was at Fibro. And I was like, you know, he's not any smarter than I am.
I love that.
Quit taking advice.
Yeah. Of course, this perpetuates, I think, even more when you understand Bitcoin and then, you know, you read finance or economics news articles, or you follow these, I sometimes on Twitter have like these quarrels with people who then just reply with, I have a PhD, you know, like this, like that. It's not about intelligence, actually thinking for yourself and trying to, like, not just accepting the fact that you give your responsibility away, right, to money manager or a bank or whatever, like, okay, please figure this out for me, right? And then you only need, as you just, I think, illustrated, like, one little discussion, or just like where you run into each other and you think, like, hey, this, why would I pay this person to do this for me, right? But what I find fascinating is that what you just said about when you were younger and you had all your dollar bills and you were stacking them, right, and so being so neat, that was basically like taking full ownership, and then eventually you ended up with doing that again, right? But what do you think happens in between when you, like, get from college and you look for someone to help you with money and stuff like it's like we forget in between, or we just follow what everyone else is doing or something, like, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that we get busy with life, right? And we also have this malware. I'll use Eric Weinstein. He uses the example of, like, we as people now have malware that's installed in our brain that we need to delete. We have these ideas, and I call them socialized ideas, but what I really mean by that is we have things that have been done a certain way, and so people accept them as truth. This is the way we should do it. So, for example, you know, you should graduate from college, you should want to, whatever all these steps are, get married, have kids, buy a house, join a country club, have a nice car, go to Florida on vacation, like, whatever the list is, people have an ideal of what a happy life looks like. But that is not thinking for yourself. And so if you follow the path that someone else has followed, you may not wind up at the best place for you. So I was speaking to some girlfriends last time. I'm in a book club, a Bitcoin, a ladies Bitcoin book club, and we read only Bitcoin books, and it's all Bitcoin women that you would know from Twitter, and it's so much fun. But I was saying the other night, we kind of got on the parenting subject and kids. And I will say this to your audience, like, you probably, people probably do not know who I really am. They probably think I am, I don't know what they think of me, but perhaps they think that I am a very, just, you know, methodical, follow the rules, let's do it this way. Like that I'm whatever.
Organized? I don't
just,
know.
Just the, you know, just would want things that other people have elevated, et cetera, whatever. Maybe we're all like that. But my yeah. point of saying all of that is that my daughter, I almost got thrown out of school a couple of times because I did not like the, you know, they have to go back to school mid-August when it's 2 million degrees in Houston to go stand in line, you know, I just felt like it was such a, there were so many things within the school system that made me just go, this is not going to help my daughter learn how to be an independent thinker for her to have to go spend literally, like, I calculated at one point, it was like 2 hours of a school day in line or lined up, whether it's for line up to go to recess, line up to go to the lunch, you know, line up to go to computer, line up to go to carpool. Like, I was like, this is ridiculous. And, you know, I wasn't a fan of the fiat food there. The school told me that she was not allowed to bring her own lunch. Everyone had to eat the school lunch. And I fought them and said, look, I've taken her to the neurologist. She always has a headache. I really believed it was because of what they were feeding her during the day, because on the weekend she did not have headaches. It actually turned out that it was probably food related. And it was also that she had an allergy because her teacher that particular year was a witch who had birds in the classroom. And Ella turned out to be allergic to these birds, and the birds would like fly all over and they would poop on the desks. And I went to the teacher and said, you know, my daughter's allergic to your bird and she has terrible headaches, and I'm taking her to the neurologist. Anyway, I'm kind of diverging, but the teacher said, well, if I get rid of the bird, no one will like Ella. Everyone will blame Ella because they love the bird. And I was just like, okay, there is something so wrong with this school system that she has to eat garbage food, listen to teachers who have that rhetoric that tell her that she will not be liked if the teacher has to get rid of the bird, right? As a parent, I wanted her to learn how to think for herself.
Yeah.
And just to like circle back to, you know, my own financial, my dealings with the financial advisor that I fired, like, we need to take responsibility for thinking for ourselves. We need to get out of accepting what the socialized program is. You know, we do this, then we do this, then we do this. Like, we need to stop.
Yeah.
I use the example of baking soda frequently. You know, whoever it was at Arm & Hammer Baking Soda that had the idea that, oh, you know, wow, we're not selling very much of this powder that comes in the yellow box because people only use half a teaspoon at a time or a teaspoon at a time when they're baking cake, baking cookies. Like, what other use case could we advertise that would get people to buy baking soda? And so whoever the genius is that came up with the marketing strategy to take a box of baking soda, literally go spend 88 cents at the grocery store to buy a box of baking soda, to bring it home, to rip the top off and throw it down the disposal in order to make our sink drain smell better. Like, that person is a genius because they have brainwashed America into thinking that is the only way to clean your sink. So my point is, like, everyone needs to just stop and ask themselves, why do I think the way I think? Whether or not it's what I throw down my sink, or, you know, whose advice I'm taking about protecting my energy, right? If I work, I get paid. How I choose to store those dollars, whether it's in Apple stock or Bitcoin or cash, I should be thinking actively. I should be critically thinking as to what really makes sense.
Yeah.
And so all that to say, you know, I feel like in Bitcoin, we're one of the rare groups of people who think. This is just a really, I think it's probably society's, I will speak only to America. I think it is America's most disappointing development. So I think we all do not think for ourselves as much as we used to.
Yeah. I think what does help with Bitcoin is that we can also prove that, you know, the thing we think should be adopted widely is actually also something that works, right? Like that, I think that does help. But yeah, I do agree. I think it's Steve Jobs who said, like, if you look around, like all these things here were made or invented by people no smarter than you or I, right? And I think it's easy to, also what I just mentioned, it's lazy, but in a human way, and easy to defer responsibility to a third party and say, like, well, if you can help me with that, that would be great, you know? And that goes from money managers to just depositing money in the bank and then just not thinking about how that actually works, right? Until you have a problem. And I think in general, it's hard for people to give themselves an uneasy feeling when they are, you know, when they decide to research, well, what do I actually think of this? Is my opinion actually valid? Or do I know enough to have an opinion? Like, that uncomfortable state is something that a lot of people avoid, right? But when you eventually perhaps end up at a real problem situation, then of course that pain and agony is way bigger than that self-induced moment, right? But yeah, I think it makes sense that people don't do this on purpose. But that's also, I do agree, in Bitcoin, you see that people have challenged themselves. And I think that's also what binds people across the globe who are into Bitcoin. Like I told you yesterday, I talked to Bob Burnett, and he coined, I think, we are all citizens of Bitcoin, he said, because we talked about that. This, right? Like, we connect. We don't know each other, but we connect in a way because we know that we both did the work and that we challenged ourselves and that we thought, like, okay, I know that I don't know everything. Oh, wow, that's actually pretty big, right? Like, no one is coming to save you or save me. And so I have to figure out what I think of this system or this thing that I'm participating in. And so that, I think, is what connects Bitcoiners across the world, that you know that the other person also did that work, despite, you know, wherever they come from, or religion or race, or all these things are so nonsensical, especially in Bitcoin. I think no one cares about all that stuff. It's totally, totally irrelevant. And yeah, I love that. I think that's a great story. And I wanted to ask you, how did understanding, or how does understanding Bitcoin, like, impact your life now? Like, what changed personally? I would say, like, the biggest personal change.
I'm not sure. I feel like I've been a very grateful person in my life. Like as I said, I have great parents, amazing grandparents. I feel very lucky. I feel as though, you know, it is my responsibility as someone who was, you know, fell out of the lucky tree. I didn't grow up wealthy, but I grew up in America. Right. I was able to have an education that, you know, others cannot. And to me, like, education is sort of like walking through a door that other people can't walk through. Mm-hmm. Because I think ultimately, I've begged my daughter to drop out of college. I feel like college, in a way, is a filter. It's not as though you go and you have all of this wisdom that then you can take with you and do something else. I've never used my degree for anything ever. I have a degree in biology. In fact, when I got into college, my dad said, you can either get a math degree or a science degree. It's your choice. But I'm not going to pay for anything else. Mm. And so I got a science degree. And I didn't love it. I didn't enjoy the study of it. I think the only class that I really did well in, that I found challenging and fun in a way and whatever, strangely, is organic chemistry.
Mm.
Although I do say that it ruined, I took it in summer school and it ruined an entire summer in New Orleans for me because I took two semesters of organic chemistry. So I feel like college was this filtering system for relationships. And, you know, it's when I did go get a job for Solomon Brothers, they looked at my resume and I'm sure, even though this was so far before the DEI narrative took hold, right? Long before, I was a woman, I had a science degree, you know,
yeah,
whatever. Like, I'm sure those things impacted me getting the job. I feel like Bitcoin just gives you this sense of purpose, or it lets you perhaps connect all of these dots that you've picked up through your life. You've had these data points, but you haven't quite known how to sew them together. And in Bitcoin, for me, it's allowed me to sew so many things together. And I think in Bitcoin too, like what I love about Bitcoin people is that we all have purpose, right? If you have found your purpose in life, you have won. Like, winning is not financial success. Winning is a community purpose. Waking up every day. I wake up every day and I think I've had a dream about Bitcoin. And I wake up thinking about something in Bitcoin.
Mm.
Right? Like, it is so fun. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's so much fun.
It's entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's so fun. I mean, when I was trading natural gas, I would wake up and literally the first thing I would do would be to turn on the weather channel to see if there'd been a shift in the weather, because every single degree shift from forecast would basically send the markets in one direction or the other, because it impacts every degree impacts load. And so it, you know, it changes the demand, obviously. But
yeah,
like now I wake up and I think about Bitcoin, and I guess I talk about Bitcoin too much. I was with a normie friend the other day who said, all you talk about is Bitcoin. Like, I just, like, you're exhausting me. You just talk about it all the time. And in a way that hurt my feelings, but then I started to think, you know, when I'm at a Bitcoin conference, or I was in Nashville recently at the Bitcoin Park for the Mining and Energy Summit, yeah, there was a lot of discussion with Bitcoin, but in our kind of just small, you know, two people talking, three or four people standing around having lunch or sitting at a table, like, no one talks about Bitcoin.
Exactly.
To your point, yeah. Like, it's such a value alignment tool that when you are Bitcoiners, you're not fighting to, like, get your values across. It's just understood.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I almost wanted to say, when you said, well, you talk so much about Bitcoin. Yeah, but it's because it touches so many things.
I know.
It touches so many dimensions of life, from energy and tech and philosophy and sociology and all these things. And that's, I think, where, at least for me, the purpose or the interest comes from. Like, I learn something new every day. Like, literally, I learn something new every day, where I'm like, oh wow, I'm surprised. I didn't think about that before, or I didn't know that before, you know. And that is, to me, well, maybe that's my personality, right? Like, that's motivating. It's just motivating that once you accept it, that you don't know everything, that when you learn something new, then that's great, right? That's literally getting 1% better or something like that every day, right? Like, if you learn every day, that's amazing. Like, that I think that keeps, like, pace in your life, and then you feel like you're never dormant if you're learning every day, right? So I think it's exciting. And yeah, I like the word entertaining. I talk about this a lot, actually. Like, I think it's entertaining. It's amazing to be in the middle of a technological tsunami, and it's also about money, and we're living through something that has not happened in a very, very long time. You know, the invention of a new money. Like, wow, what a big thing is that, you know? So that for me is also one of the things to, when I started this podcast, I felt like I'm going to talk about this for the next 50 years. So why not just start now? And yeah, just have fun learning every day. That's basically it for me. Yeah. Fun.
I know. I was looking up, I wanted to remind myself, yesterday I was at a luncheon at the Houston Petroleum Club. There's, as I think I mentioned, there's this conference going on in the oil and gas. It's traditionally an oil and gas conference. It's been going on for decades. It's kind of where a lot of exploration production guys come, and they have maps of, you know, parcels that they're selling and projects that they're selling, and there's industry tech there. And anyway, in the last 3 years, there's a big Bitcoin mining hub that's at the end of the convention center with a lot of the folks that you and I know. So yesterday there was a luncheon at the Petroleum Club, and it was a Bitcoin and energy lunch. Anyone could go. And the speaker was Chris Alfano, and he's the CEO of 360 Mining. They're based in Texas, and they mine off of, you know, off of production. So they're an off-grid miner, not an on-grid miner.
Yeah.
He gave a presentation, and I mean, I've worked in the energy world. I feel like I speak, you know, kitchen energy. You know, some people speak kitchen Spanish. I speak kitchen energy.
Yeah.
I learned so many things. Or a way to reframe how to think about or how to explain Bitcoin to energy folks yesterday in his conversation. And I was like, you know, like, where else are you actually considered an expert, but every time you go to something, you're learning from someone else?
Yeah.
Like, this is the coolest moment in time where, you know, I think the next wave of adoption comes from the energy companies. It's when they see Bitcoin, they can't unsee it. When they figure out that it is accretive to their business models, they will have to embrace it. There's no way they can say, you know, no, we're going to use the slide rule, even though there's a computer, right? They cannot. And it's folks like Chris and a lot of the other guys that were on this panel, Mario Gutierrez with Giga and Steve Barber with Upstream Data, Dan Morrison with Amalgamated Sludge. These guys are out there educating in the energy space. And this is going to allow so much innovation in our energy. It should reframe the way that we all think about energy, ultimately. I think we lose the narrative that energy production is bad. We get back to the facts that onshore energy production directly impacts our national security, and having energy infrastructure that is strengthened and having more energy production through Bitcoin, it is, you know, the biggest, best use case of my personal energy, their personal energy.
Yeah.
Because we're fighting for a much bigger goal, right? We're fighting for freedom.
Yeah.
So, to your point, like, we can wake up and learn every day something that is, you know, we're like bearing witness to the greatest, not only technological shift, not only innovation, but like the ability for us to take control again of thought process and belief in ourselves and helping people find purpose. I mean, I have a friend who I'm actually going to have lunch with him today. He is a founder of a big energy, a public energy company, and he's retired. And I have lunch with him probably once every 6 months. And I always say the same thing. I really want you to start coming to the Bitcoin stuff with me. You know, I can tell he wants to get back in the game. He doesn't want to be retired. He raises longhorns. He has a ranch, and he raises longhorns, and he drives them to Fort Worth, and he sells them in the stockyards. Like, but I can tell he misses being in the game. And I'm like, you just got to, like, I'm waiting for the moment when he goes, okay, I'm ready. Like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, the light bulb has to go on.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I also wanted to talk about this because I saw in your pinned tweet, it says energy companies have a duty to their shareholders to monetize every molecule. I think that's what you just referred to, right? Like Bitcoin could help them to actually, I don't want to say never waste any energy molecule again, but it will come pretty close, right? So it's the perfect instrument for them to not only optimize their business model, right? But actually get way more return on any investment that they do. Like I talked to Daniel Batten a few episodes ago, and I said, I need to share this thought with you because I think this totally makes sense, but it's not happening, right? Like when you like build all these wind farms, then you pay for the construction, you pay for the materials, you pay for everything upfront. It's just a big investment upfront, right? And then sometimes the turbines don't turn even when there's wind because there's no capacity on the net. I think that's a problem in almost every country, right? So, but that entire upfront investment is already done. And then when the turbines are not turning, like your ROI goes down just on the usage of the thing you built, right? So why not just let them turn always when the wind blows? And you just mine Bitcoin when nobody wants to use it on the grid. And I was like, and then you even get, you could possibly get like over 100% ROI on everything, the upfront investment, the usage, like all the write-offs, all these things. And so I said to him, like, I just want to check with you, like, is this too simply thought or not? And he was like, no, you're totally right. But that's the entire thing. Like to go back to what we just talked about, the think for yourself part, it sounds so simple. And that's why people in a complex industry, I'd say, have a hard time gripping this thought, right? Like, could it be like this simple to just harvest that energy all the time or whatever, you know, the methane flaring, etc.? It's the same type of concept. Do you think that's something that people run into, that it seems too good to be true or something like that?
No, I don't. I don't think that they think it's too good to be true. I, in my own conversations, they don't think it's too good to be true. They just, I was recently sitting with the former chairman of a huge retail electric provider based, and there are two based in Houston. And I was having dinner with one of them. It was the first time I'd ever met him. I was with a friend, and then he and his wife, and first time I'd ever met them. They were so nice. And the question came up, what do you do? And I said, oh, I work in Bitcoin. And he was like, oh, tell me about it. I have been wanting to figure this out. Tell me about Bitcoin.
Great.
And so maybe I gave him like a 5-minute pitch. I kind of have like a 5-minute here. Let me tell you, if you're an energy guy, why you should care.
Yeah.
And his response was, is that what this is all about? Really, like, my point was, if you're an energy guy, like, you can think that it's for money launderers, terrorists, you can hate Bitcoin, but it literally is going from the slide rule, whatever, to the computer. It literally is the zero to one innovation that allows you, again, to get away from this socialized idea that throwing away energy or allowing energy to go unused is okay. It is not okay. Mm-hmm. You know, hello, Elizabeth Warren, you have this all wrong.
Yeah.
We have more energy in Texas to power the Bitcoin ecosystem multiple times over that we waste, right? Like, Bitcoin is not eating all of the energy in the world, nor will it melt the planet.
Yeah.
So, but these guys, all they hear is what's on Fox News, right? All they hear is what's in the Bloomberg article that gets perpetuated.
Yeah.
Which, like, the whole media thing is another subject I can barely even speak about these days because I keep having arguments with folks in my circle and telling them they've really, like, got to stop reading the mainstream news. Like, it's just, I think it's very, again, I think at the end of the day, like, if I can go so far down the rabbit hole, I think it is a threat to national security when you print things about Bitcoin that are untrue to further what you believe is the correct political narrative, what you believe will get you votes, right? Oh, Bitcoin is using too much energy. We're going to shut Bitcoin down. Like, then you've got all these climate zealots who want to vote for these politicians who say things that are completely factually unprovable and incorrect. So all that to say, here in Texas, my experience with the energy community is once they see it, and then when you can paint the connection between them monetizing molecules, which are, is accretive to their business model, and make the connection to national security, right? Like, they're on board. Energy guys are all about freedom. Energy guys understand national security.
Yeah.
And really, they're the smart, I think they're the smartest people on earth.
And like you said, they don't even have to like Bitcoin to and they can still profit from it, right? If they can just up their ROI on whatever their operation is, that could be a big enough incentive already, I'd say.
Yeah.
Right? And the Bitcoin is an added bonus, no?
Yeah, 100%. And so Chris Alfano yesterday from 360 Mining, he had these slides. And I mean, one of them was a chart of basically, okay, Henry Hub pricing is the natural gas benchmark. So commodities, when you look at the futures price on CNBC, or you look up the futures price for natural gas or crude oil or whatever, there's actually a delivery location. And so for natural gas, it's called Henry Hub, and it's located in Erath, Louisiana. So that's what people think of when they, you know, go, what's the natural gas price today? $2.50. But actually, what guys are getting is much less, because in order to get gas to market, what do you need? You need a pipeline. And there are all kinds of fees. I mean, booking pipeline space is a little bit like booking an airline ticket. You have to book. You can book on a daily basis. You can contract out for 30-day pipeline, long-term pipeline capacity. But you're getting typically less than Henry Hub at the end of the day. The margins are razor thin. With Bitcoin mining, Chris's chart was basically like, okay, here's the Henry Hub price. Here's the realized Henry Hub price. And then here is the actual realized price. If we converted natural gas into Bitcoin, here's the realized price of the natural gas. And like, in some instances, it was like $20 or $30 or $7 or, right? It's more than $2.50.
Yeah.
And so when you explain this, when you show people factually, here's what it will do for you. And so let's just say that you're a producer and you, you know, a lot of people talk about the flared gas narrative, which is definitely a thing, right? Bitcoin can help reduce flared gas, and that's good for a variety of reasons. It's operationally good because in many instances, if you have oil coming out of the ground, you have associated gas coming with it. There may be a pipeline there to take the oil away, but there's no pipeline in place yet for the gas. And so that gas gets flared. So that's bad for the operator, right? That he is literally lighting capital on fire. He spent capital to go. He coordinated capital from the market to go put, you know, drill bits into the ground to get that oil up. And part of his production, he's literally having to light on fire. So it's good from that sense. But if those guys had dropped Bitcoin miners, and when they drop Bitcoin miners down on site, which is what Steve Barber at Upstream Data is helping folks do, love their company, Giga Energy doing the same thing, they are providing, you know, tiny scale and large scale, you know, containers, data centers, hash huts, whatever you want to call them, for those oil and gas operators to just drop down on site. So then those guys don't have to light it on fire. And then let's just say that you do have a pipeline to put gas into, but the pipeline could be, you know, maybe your realized price of the pipeline. Dan Morrison yesterday, he has gas in New Mexico, and he said last week he was getting 64 cents for his gas. Or you could be mining Bitcoin and you could turn that into like $12.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you cannot unsee the benefit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I see that we eventually, you know, this is a big statement and maybe it's too much, but I think that we eventually use all energy to mine Bitcoin. Instead of using the surplus or this much energy to mine Bitcoin, I think that we eventually direct all of our energy into Bitcoin mining operations. And then we live on the excess. And I also believe that we drive the price of energy much, much lower. Because as Bitcoin miners are setting up operations and distributing electricity around the globe, you know, to your point of the guy spinning the turbines, it's more operationally efficient, it's more creative to business models for energy to be running all of the time. And actually, a few years ago, I had somebody on LinkedIn reach out to me, a guy that works at Entergy. And he actually works on the turbines. He's one of their turbine engineers. And he had written a paper that he shared with me about how it's, you know, obviously not only accretive to keep running so that they can keep selling power, but that from a mechanical standpoint, from a maintenance standpoint, to keep those running is better for the turbines than shutting them off and turning them back on, which makes perfect sense. I mean, as someone who like lives in Houston and drives short distances a lot, I wear out the starter of my car more frequently than someone who, you know, gets in their car and drives 600 miles and turns it off and doesn't drive it again. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you think that there will be like new energy companies that will also just be Bitcoin companies? So whenever someone starts a new utility company, that it will also just be a Bitcoin company at the same time? I heard this as an idea. I thought it was pretty interesting, actually.
Do I think there will be new energy? You know, actually, what I think is probably going to happen in the very short term is I think that Halliburton or Schlumberger, these oilfield service companies, I think they're going to gobble up the companies that are innovating in the Bitcoin space.
Right. And in that way, save themselves.
Well, look, I mean, innovate. We need Schlumberger and we need Halliburton for a very long time, right? Mm. We need oilfield service companies. We are going to need them. We are not going to stop using oil by 2050. Anybody who believes that should go, you know, really look. I was going to make a smart ass comment, but that is not true. We are going to keep using it. And we need those companies. But again, Bitcoin mining is such a tool in their tool base to allow them, you know, operationally to improve their margins.
Yeah.
So that's why I pinned that tweet. And this is why I talk about this all the time. Like, I believe it is absolutely their duty to their shareholders or their stakeholders to use every tool at their disposal.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is not illegal. Bitcoin mining is not harmful to the planet. You know, these energy CEOs, and at least the ones that I speak to, they see Elizabeth Warren, but they're not Elizabeth Warren fans. They may acknowledge that, you know, what they heard from her initially was what they believed. But when they're being exposed to guys down at NAPE, right, this big Bitcoin mining hub, as the oil and gas guys drift down to the Bitcoin area of this big oil and gas conference and they're having conversations, you can see that things are changing. And they are, actually. I mean, you can see it at this conference. The first year that the Bitcoiners were there, like, they were like, you know, the space was this big. The footprint was this big of the Bitcoin area. And now it's this, you know, sizable part of the convention.
Yeah, I love it. So you mentioned you're in Texas. Of course, there's a lot of stuff going on with the state of Texas and the federal government and like all the other states, or like lots of other states also supporting Texas. And there's a lot of different states that adopt new legislation about Bitcoin. Like how do you see regulatory or policy changes like locally or also, well, the federal government goes against the states, I think, in a lot of different ways. Like, do you think that could threaten or strengthen Bitcoin? What are your ideas there?
Yeah, I think Texas should become its own country. I personally am so tired of the narrative that we should put up with this, the greater good or the socialism that is taking over the United States, right? Like, we don't want to become California here in Texas. We are going to make more energy. We're going to use more energy. Energy is the root of success within every individual. You know, I'm proud of our governor here in Texas. He last week gave an interview that said, you know, we support Bitcoiners. We support Bitcoin mining operations. We support innovation. You know, we are proud that when Chexit occurred, he didn't say this specifically, but when Chexit occurred, so many of the miners moved to Texas. And we've seen it, you know, with other technology companies. So many have left California and come to Texas. Elon Musk was just tweeting last week, you know, should he move his headquarters? Should he move another branch of something to Texas? Like, we've seen this for decades. I think there's more job creation in Texas than every other state combined. That may not quite be true right now, but it was true within the last few years. I haven't looked recently at what the statistic is, but the point is, it holds true. There's more job creation here than almost anywhere else.
Yeah.
Which is terrible for traffic, by the way. I mean, I grew up here and it's changed a whole lot.
And do you think Bitcoin could be a differentiator, like for states to compete with each other? I think Balaji talks a lot about this, right? Like, you have red states, blue states, but there's also gray states, he says, that more adopt like technology, you know. And then, of course, one of his examples is Bitcoin, where if the digital population or the citizens of Bitcoin grow in the digital realm, and they are Americans, then it would also be easier or more, they have a big incentive to actually move to another state, for example, that has more Bitcoin-friendly policies. Like, do you think Bitcoin could be a big subject for states to compete in this way?
I really hope that it becomes that. I don't think it is today, because you have, you know, I don't want to keep bashing Elizabeth Warren, but I think her energy policy is lacking. You know, her support for reducing energy production in the United States and for putting windmills out into the Massachusetts waters that are, you know, harmful to the environment, not to mention, like, they don't last very long. They're not, you know, I don't know if you've ever visited the East Coast near the sea, but like, the salt water is incredibly destructive to property. I hope that Bitcoin becomes a competitive industry for states. That would be a win for the United States overall.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a competitive issue today, because, you know, New York has the BIT license. They don't want Bitcoin mining there. Certainly, you know, Elizabeth Warren doesn't want Bitcoin mining in her state. California, you know, they don't want Bitcoin mining.
Yeah.
They flush their toilet only on Fridays, right? Like, they don't want to use water. They don't want to use power. I mean,
all right.
Yeah.
All right. So if Bitcoin is digital energy and energy rules the world, what are your ideas about, like, global game theory about adoption of Bitcoin? Like, once bigger companies and nation states figure out that this is like the first and only finite digital commodity and thus energy, which can give them power, like, what do you think will happen? I mean, we have El Salvador adopting it, right? But that was a country that was really, like, down and out. I yesterday I tweeted this idea of, like, I wonder who the first follower will be, you know. Like, they will legitimize a trend in some way. Like, what are your thoughts on like the global adoption there?
Well, I think we're losing, and I think that we will see, you know, I think we will see the UAE, or I think we will see Russia be the next adopter. I think it's an energy rich country. that it's the next huge adopter of Bitcoin. And honestly, why would they do that? Because, you know, it's, I didn't know anything about the petrodollar situation before I got into Bitcoin. And Alex Gladstein, I think, has the best piece. It's in Bitcoin Magazine. If you Google Bitcoin Magazine, Alex Gladstein, the petrodollar, this fantastic article comes up, which explains it. But why in the world would Russia ever agree to take their own natural resources? Right. They have coordinated capital. It's Russians on the ground in the fields harvesting the crop, which is energy.
Siberia somewhere. Yeah.
Right. Why do they sell that for dollars?
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, probably the greatest misstep of the US was cutting Russia out of the SWIFT system, was censoring their ability to transact with the world.
Yeah.
Not that I am against the idea of holding Russia accountable for actions that we feel are intolerable, but you've pushed them to use a different money.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe they're in a coordinated effort with India and China, North Korea, whomever, to create their own financial settlement system. There is already a financial settlement system. It's called Bitcoin. It works 24 hours a day, and it can't be controlled by the leader of North Korea or China or Russia or the United States.
Well, it actually creates trust, right? Like it's the Byzantine general problem in a sense. Like if they want to work together, but they don't really trust each other, then Bitcoin is probably the best way to collaborate on, you know, their agitation against the West, because they don't have to trust each other, but they can still use it.
Right. And we know that they're already mining Bitcoin, right? Like we see projects in the UAE that are going up right now. We see them happening in partnership with public companies here in the United States. I'm sure they're happening without companies from the United States. You know, this is really the first time that, you know, getting back to like monetizing molecules that you can't otherwise monetize. So I was speaking to a Bitcoin mining company who has gone down into the jungle, and I won't say where, but into a pristine jungle where there is natural gas. There's oil and there's natural gas. And because of the topography, right, it's a very mountainous area.
Yeah.
There's pipeline in order to take the oil and get it to market. But because natural gas is not a liquid and it has to be pressurized in a pipeline and every, you know, there's no takeaway. It's much more of a feat to transport it. And so they don't.
Yeah.
They flare it.
Yeah.
So if I am a country with unsophisticated energy infrastructure, but I'm rich in natural resources, and now I have a way to monetize that for my citizen,
to then build other stuff, right? Like
But Elizabeth Warren, you keep telling people how terrible it is for the environment, right? Like it's actually cleaning up energy that's being flared in one of the most pristine, heavily forested parts of the world.
Yeah, I agree. I think it will also be an Arab country, probably. I really like the illustration of, yeah, why would you sell real energy, like the energy of the world, right? Oil for something that can be printed without using any energy. Like just that equation does not make any sense. And what you mentioned about Russia and cutting them off from the SWIFT system, like if any country will probably think, well, if they do it to Russia, they can do it to us. So maybe that's for them the signal to think for themselves maybe more and be less dependent. Yeah. And for me, this is also like one of the things that I put in the like entertaining category, you know, like, you know, it's going to happen. We don't really know when, but that's why it's just fun to follow this, right? And to just see which domino will fall. And then I do really believe in like a global game theory where if one country goes, then the rest has to go or you will lose. So even if you're remotely thinking about adopting Bitcoin or studying it or whatever, there will be like an oh shit moment and like you have to adopt it. Yeah, and I just find that really entertaining. So I always describe that this is like we are sitting in a stadium on a seat, we're just watching this play out, you know, and then having fun along the way. But yeah, I find that super interesting. And I would be surprised if it doesn't happen this or next year, actually. But yeah, we'll see. I wanted to ask you two more questions. What excites you the most about Bitcoin's future?
You know, probably I'll go back to what I've said a while ago. I was with someone that's really close to me earlier in the week, and the person actually called me and said, "I feel really down. Like I feel like I'm in this." He used the word Groundhog Day. I'm in this Groundhog Day, and I get up and I go to work and I do the same thing, and I come home and I'm with the dogs and go for a walk and I'm outside and it's nice. He said, but I just can't. I just don't know what I'm here for. And I said, you know, I really think that you would just like get lit on fire with excitement and enthusiasm if you would just spend a little time with Bitcoin. And this is a person that is an avid reader, one of the smartest people that I've ever met, one of the most philosophically, you know, emotionally smart people. And I think what gets me the most excited is that it is this transference from, you know, the Bitcoin network as an energy network. It can transform and transfer some of that power to us personally and give us hope and purpose. And that's what we all have in common when we work in Bitcoin or are a Bitcoiner. Maybe we're a nurse or we're a, you know, anything else. You don't have to work in Bitcoin to be a Bitcoiner. But yeah, you are filled with, oh my gosh, the world's going to be better tomorrow than it is today. So that's probably what gives me the most excitement. It has nothing to do with the price. I really don't. I mean, obviously, we all care about price. We don't want Bitcoin to self-destruct, and I think we're way past the point. But when you dig in and you quit calling it an asset, and you quit talking about it as an allocation, yeah. Like when I tell people that I'm 100% allocated to Bitcoin, I mean like mind, body, spirit, right? Like I am. I believe this is a divine moment in our time to refocus all of our energy to like unplug the malware, reset the, you know, get rid of the malware that was downloaded for the last 30 years, 40 years, 50 years of your life. And let's like shake the Astro sketch. Let's start again.
Yeah. Yeah. It will probably not surprise you, but I have the same experience. Like in the past 10 years, my attention to Bitcoin has grown. I think like my time allocation, like with different things that I do, but it is the main thing in my thinking. And it's definitely not only about price, especially what you said. I think I there's so many dimensions from philosophy or just learning about finance. Like I don't have a background in that. And, yeah, again, like learning every day. So I think that's a great way to almost end this conversation. I want to ask you my last question that I ask everyone, which is, what is a core belief that you will never let go?
Oh, you should have warned me.
Sorry.
No, core belief. So I wrote a book. It's not, I haven't published it. I call it a book. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a list of like bumper sticker wisdom. But when I had Ella, I kind of had this like overwhelming like fear that I would die before she was old enough for me to like impart, you know, kind of motherly wisdom on her. And so I started writing a list of kind of tips for life. And now it's actually turned into a shared note on our iPhone. And we talk about the list and we add things to the list. And she wrote her college essays about the list.
Oh, wow.
But number one on the list is, I believe that we're here to serve others. So rule number one, be a good human.
Love that.
When you are a good human, like everything else works out. When you realize that I truly believe, like, I am here to serve others. It's my favorite thing about my job. I'm in business development. I'm not an engineer. I don't have an MBA. I don't have technical knowledge in Bitcoin. But I do have really strong relationships, and I spend a lot of time trying to understand other people's businesses and what brings them value. And so to me, that's why I love my work within the Bitcoin community, as it overlaps in energy, because as I said, like, I speak a little, you know, energy, kitchen energy speak, and I speak Bitcoin. So understanding how to add value to their operations, like, brings me so much joy. I can't think of anything else that would bring me as much joy. And now that my daughter works in Bitcoin too, it's like, oh my God.
Like, great job. Well done. Get to do this together. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that. I love that. I have a 5-year-old, and when I see what Ella is doing, I think I once tweeted it to you, like, you can be really proud, I think. And I think what you just mentioned is, or shared, is also what you instilled in her. So I think that's very cool to see. So yeah, thanks for sharing, and thanks for having this conversation with me. And let's do it somewhere again in the future. It was fun. I will link to your X profile so people can follow you as well. And thank you.
I really appreciate it. Always love talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's @BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening.